Today is Monday, October 7th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Coming up, American troops are starting a pullout from along Turkey's border with Syria before a likely Turkish military move against Kurdish forces.
That the Syrian Kurds say will overturn 5 years of achievements in the battle against the Islamic State group.
Also ahead, U.S. President Donald Trump intensifies his criticism of the Democrat-led impeachment inquiry as a second whistleblower comes forward, and the latest as protests continue in Hong Kong. These stories and more are next. U.S.-backed Kurdish-led forces said American troops began pulling back Monday from positions along the border in northeast Syria ahead of an expected Turkish invasion that the Syrian Kurds say will overturn 5 years of achievements in the battle against the Islamic State group. Kurdish-led Syrian Democratic Forces spokesman Kino Gabriel says the SDF has been, quote, stabbed in the back by a surprise U.S. statement Monday that American forces will not be involved in a Turkish operation in northern Syria. Joining us now on the phone is VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb. Carla, welcome to the program.
Hi, Steve.
So what can you tell us about this announcement?
Well, the announcement has brought a lot of criticism, to put it lightly. I mean, a lot of Republicans and Democrats have come out very strongly against this decision to pull out from northern Syria. And it's not just the Democrats and the Republicans in Congress. The Pentagon and the State Department have also made similar such statements. The State Department said, quote, this is not a good idea. And the Pentagon has said that any uncoordinated military operation by Turkey would be of grave concern. They are saying that the U.S. Armed Forces will not support or be involved in any such operation. But the biggest hitch of this is that if the United States is going to move out of the way, what exactly is going to stop Turkey from doing this? And that's the question that none of these agencies have been able to answer at this point.
Has there been any information about the communication of how this decision was made? Because Secretary Mark Esper on Friday was saying that the United States would still be there, correct?
Well, I mean, this all started apparently with a phone call between President Erdogan of Turkey and President Donald Trump. And after that phone call, it appears that some deliberations were discussed on Erdogan coming to Washington, for one, and then also about this safe zone or security mechanism, depending on how you're looking at it, if you're Turkish or if you're American. And when this came up, it's unclear whether or not Secretary of State Mike Pompeo was on the call. I have not been able to confirm whether or not Secretary Esper was on the call, but I have been told that he has been talking with his Turkish counterparts. And just as early as Friday, he was saying that he reiterated to his counterpart that the mechanism that they have in place right now, where the United States and Turkey work together to secure the area without any sort of military incursion done by the Turks, that was the best way forward. So that is why it was so jarring to see this information come out on Sunday that the United States was going to kind of move out of the way, because it seemed like the United States was very much entrenched in what was going on in northern Syria and was very much in support of its allies.
Is there anything else you can tell us about what the Defense Department is or the Pentagon plans to do now?
Well, it's unclear because we're hearing conflicting things. We're hearing that the United States is pulling out from northern Syria. President Trump is the commander-in-chief. Let's not forget this. So he is the one who can tell the U.S. forces what to do. But there are still 1,000 U.S. troops in Syria. And so this has happened before. We heard back when Secretary of Defense Mattis resigned over a similar issue with President Trump trying to lead the Kurdish allies in northern Syria. We saw over the next couple of weeks following that that the United States really did stay in Syria after all, that the president kind of changed his mind and the U.S. didn't move. We're already seeing some sort of inklings that this could potentially happen again, because we saw President Donald Trump tweeting, as I have stated before, and just to reiterate, if Turkey does anything that I consider to be off limits, I will destroy and obliterate the economy. That's what he's tweeted, the economy of Turkey. So we're already seeing a little bit of backtracking, and we'll just have to watch to see what happens in the coming days.
Carla Babb is VOA's Pentagon correspondent. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Iraqi authorities pledged on Monday to hold accountable any members of security forces who acted wrongly in dealing with anti-government protesters. The military is also withdrawing troops from the Sadr City neighborhood in northeastern Baghdad in a move apparently aimed at de-escalation. Overnight, at least 13 people were killed in clashes between protesters and security forces. Since the protests in Iraq began nearly a week ago, more than 100 people have been killed. The 2019 Nobel Prize for Physiology or Medicine was awarded Monday to two Americans and a British scientist for their discoveries in how body cells sense and react to oxygen levels. Their work have paved the way for new strategies to fight anemia, cancer, and other diseases. The White House said that trade negotiators from Beijing and Washington will begin meeting Thursday. Two sides will look to build on the deputy-level talks for the past few weeks. Topics of discussion will include forced technology transfer, intellectual property rights, services, non-tariff barriers, agriculture, and enforcement. U.S. President Donald Trump continued attacking lawmakers as the Democrat-led House pushes toward the impeachment inquiry against the president. Mr. Trump was reiterating his criticism of Congressman Adam Schiff, the chair of the House Intelligence Committee, and the Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, who tasked Schiff with leading the impeachment inquiry. Joining us now in the studio is VOA national correspondent Jim Malone to unpack where the inquiry stands now. Jim, welcome.
Hi, Steve.
So where exactly are things now that we have a second whistleblower?
The House Democrats are moving ahead. They want to hear from the second whistleblower in this case to see to what extent the information corroborates the first whistleblower. And as we know, the president and his allies attacked the first whistleblower. So any additional information here is likely to bolster the Democrats' case at this point. Democrats also, by the way, today are asking for additional documents and information from the Office of Management and Budget and the Defense Department related to anything they know about the Ukraine military funds that were held up for a time, which is, of course, at the heart of this whole issue with the president dealing with the president of Ukraine.
Right. And I guess it should be kind of explained that the first whistleblower complaint was someone in who had information brought to them and then filed the complaint with the IG. And the second whistleblower said they have firsthand knowledge, correct?
Yeah. And look, what we're looking at here is the Democrats are building a case. Okay. So where it's headed right now, it seems the consensus is at some point it's likely to move from an impeachment inquiry to likely perhaps a move to have an impeachment vote in the House. And if that happens, we're moving into another chapter in this saga. And in the end, if the House does vote to impeach, and all you need is Democratic votes for that simple majority vote in the House, it would then move to a Senate trial. Republicans control the Senate, and that right now is seen as the backstop for the president, that they don't see the votes in the Senate to actually convict the president of any high crimes and misdemeanors that would result in his removal from office.
In your discussions with analysts and watching the political landscape of the country as the national correspondent, where do you see the discussions taking place as far as there have been some Republicans have said that this bears looking into, but in terms of the vote, as you said, the Republicans will block conviction.
Yeah, on the Republican side, I think there's three camps. I think there's the group that is vocally in support of the president. There's a very smaller group that has expressed some concerns. There's some sort of cracks in the veneer there. And then it's the largest group, and you're not hearing much from them. They are remaining quiet. They're not vocal defenders of the president at this point, and they're not vocal critics. I think they're going to be watching where public opinion is headed. The polls have been creeping up in terms of support for impeachment, or at least for the inquiry, but it also shows the country is still divided at this point. So I think the task ahead for Democrats, if they want to continue to go down this road, is to build support bipartisan when they can to sort of make the case that whatever is at stake here rises to the level of an impeachable offense, which is what Congress has to determine.
Jim Malone is VOA's national correspondent. Thank you so much for stopping by and explaining everything to us.
Okay.
This is Science in a Minute. According to a new study published in the Astronomical Journal, about 3.5 million years ago, which on a galactic scale is quite recent, there was a colossal explosion of energy at the center of the Milky Way. The explosion, which scientists call a Seyfert flare, sent out powerful cone-shaped beams of radiation that sliced through our galaxy and a good distance into deep space. The researchers say the flare was so powerful that it affected the Magellanic Stream some 200,000 light-years from the Milky Way. Study authors who used data from the Hubble Space Telescope to make their findings estimate the blast lasted for about 300,000 years. The research team behind the study says this explosion was too enormous to have been set off by anything other than nuclear activity associated with the supermassive black hole at the center of the Milky Way, known as Sagittarius A star. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Hong Kong struggled to recover Monday, with the metro only partially functioning and infrastructure extensively damaged after scores of protesters were arrested in violent clashes overnight that drew the first warning from the Chinese military. Tens of thousands of protesters marched peacefully through the center of the Chinese-ruled city earlier on Sunday, wearing face masks in defiance of a colonial-era emergency powers that threatened them with 1 year in prison for hiding their faces. For more on the weekend's protests, I spoke with VOA's Patsy Wanakusara, who's in Hong Kong. So, Patsy, you arrived in Hong Kong over the weekend. Tell us what you saw during the weekend's protests.
Right, so we arrived Saturday morning, and just a few hours before we arrived, which is Friday midnight, that's when the government of Hong Kong enacted the anti-mask ban. So basically they're saying that anybody who wears a mask is liable to prison time, all sorts of penalties, and they're doing this in a way using national emergency powers, so bypassing the Legislative Council. They're saying that this is necessary because there's been a lot of vandalism, there's been a lot of violent behavior from the protesters, and this is what the government's trying to do to stop it. But activists see it as a further sign of crackdown. They see this mask ban as just the beginning, and that further government bans, perhaps on internet freedom and other freedoms, might follow under this national emergency law. So that was Saturday morning when we arrived, and we, in the afternoon, we did see some protests. Local media says that it's about a couple of hundred to a thousand, but they did disappear quite quickly, and it was quite peaceful. I think the protesters were trying to save their energy for the next day, which was much, much bigger, Sunday afternoon, even though it was raining, but the crowds that came up, you know, by some calculations, over a million. Organizers said that they were expecting up to over 2 million. And that's when some of the clashes with police happened. So the police did use tear gas. The protesters hit back with some Molotov cocktails. In fact, just about 500 meters away from our hotel. There was also some riot police moving in just a few moments after we were filming some protesters vandalizing some subway station. So it was a day of clashes and unrest on Sunday. And then today, because this is a holiday, it's a traditional day in Chinese custom where people pay respect to their ancestors by going to the grave. It was quiet, and there were some small protests, but everything was peaceful. And we don't really know what's going to happen in the days to come this week, because usually the protest schedules are released in the morning.
You mentioned that, you know, life has pretty much returned to normal on this national holiday, you know, no really big clashes. Are people able to get around as they once were? Because from Friday through the weekend, the MRT, the metro system, was closed down. What can you tell us about the status of that system?
Right. So some of the stations were closed down on Sunday and as well as Saturday. You know, the government does this to deter the protesters from coming out. They also shut down the entire system early on Sunday after we hear of vandalism. Today, some of the stations are also closed, but but mostly people were able to get around. I think the plan is to open the transportation system tomorrow, but then again, we'll see. Situation is always really fluid. That's what's really fascinating about the city is that, you know, this is, we forget that behind all these images of protests that Hong Kong is still a very bustling metropolitan. 7 million people live here, and they still go about their daily lives, except their daily lives are interspersed with these regular protests that they have as they continue to fight what they see as a repression on their freedom and their democracy.
Patsy Wita-Kuswara reports for VOA, normally from the White House, but now she's in Hong Kong for the Greta Van Susteren Plugged In television show. Thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
North Korea has walked away from working-level nuclear talks with the United States, with Pyongyang's top negotiator saying Saturday he was greatly disappointed with Washington's inflexible approach. The quick breakdown of the first substantive nuclear negotiations in months raises the possibility North Korea will intensify its provocations, days after testing a new medium-range ballistic missile designed to be launched from a submarine. VOA's Bill Gallo has more.
On the surface, it doesn't look good. North Korea storming out of its first nuclear talks with the U.S. in months. But it's not new. North Korean negotiators for years have tried to gain the upper hand by being the ones to walk away from talks. What is new in the equation is Donald Trump, who's already walked away twice from talks with North Korea. The first time, just days before his initial summit with Kim Jong-un.
I've decided to terminate the planned summit in Singapore on June 12th.
A few weeks later, Trump did meet Kim. But at their second summit in Hanoi, Trump walked out early on Kim, who had traveled nearly 3 days by train. For now, North Korea says the next step is up to Trump. As the North Korean delegation headed home, its top envoy warned of shocking actions if the U.S. doesn't give in soon. Bill Gallo, VOA News, Seoul.
Now to put things into broader perspective and where discussions may go from here, I spoke with Harry Kazianis, Senior Director of Korea Studies at the Center for the National Interest.
So, Harry, I want to begin here. You know, North Korea is saying that they are very disappointed with the United States at the result of these working-level talks in Sweden over the weekend. Where do you see things going here, and is the North Korean statement really all that much of a surprise?
Well, where I think we're going to is the absolute brink. What the North Koreans are doing is actually playing, I think, a very dangerous game of diplomatic chicken, which, in all honesty, could blow up in their face. I think what the North Koreans have decided is I think they feel that President Trump has been weakened by all the talk of impeachment here in Washington at the moment. And I think they feel like this is their chance to extract maximum concessions, if you will, from Washington. And that is very possible. I can understand why they would think that. I mean, obviously, the president is going to most likely be impeached with charges being brought up in the Senate, probably will be acquitted, but that will damage him politically quite significantly for a long time. So the North Koreans might feel that this is the opportunity to try extract as much as they can from Washington. However, this is President Trump we're talking about, and he doesn't operate by all the same conventional political rules that a lot of other presidents have used. And that might be the opportunity where he decides to say, forget all of this, and to actually push back on the North Koreans. If that is what does happen here, if the North Koreans do essentially miscalculate, we could be back to the days of fire and fury in 2017 and nuclear threats. I hope that doesn't happen, but that's where the trend lines, I think, point to.
As you said, this is, you know, a brinkmanship game between Pyongyang and Washington. Is this another attempt to try and solidify a direct contact, another summit between Kim Jong-un and Donald Trump, the U.S. president, because it seems that, you know, Pyongyang really wants to have that top-level kind of communication rather than these working-level talks?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, look, I don't think it takes a rocket scientist, no pun intended, to figure out who the weakest sort of diplomatic person in this whole game is, and that's Donald Trump. I think if I'm Kim Jong-un, I'm going to stall in these working level talks. I'm going to do everything I possibly can to get that meeting with Trump, knowing that he's probably the least informed player in the whole game, and to try to get concessions directly out of him. However, I don't think that strategy is going to work this time. President Trump right now, as we can all see through his Twitter feed, is completely obsessed with the impeachment process. In fact, he didn't tweet anything about North Korea over these last few days when talks broke down. So I think that's a very clear signal to show that Trump, while I think he's interested in the North Korea problem, he's much more concerned right now about his own domestic political problems than anything else. I think for him, Korea is sort of a sideshow at the moment, which is terrible considering the stakes involved. But I think Kim would be very, very mistaken to try to get that next fourth meeting with Trump. And Trump has actually already said that if he was to have a meeting with Kim, he'd want to know, quote unquote, what he would get out of it or something like that. So I don't think Trump is as eager to have that meeting as Kim would be.
And this is coming at a time when Japan and South Korea are having very difficult ties. Where do you see, you know, the greatest risks on the peninsula from a defense standpoint and a regional security standpoint?
Well, I think there's two. I think the first thing is this North Korean buildup of missile capabilities. And essentially what they've done is essentially copied the Chinese model of a military buildup. They don't obviously have the resources that Beijing does, but let's face it, you're not going to take on the United States one-on-one in a military contest. I would also say, too, that the Trump administration has made a huge mistake not getting involved in the diplomatic spat between Seoul and Tokyo. The best way that you're going to be able to contain the North Korean threat is a robust set of alliances that can counter North Korea, that can enforce sanctions, but can also offer the best concessions if North Korea is truly serious.
Harry Kazianis is the Senior Director of Korean Studies at the Center for National Interest. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Now, there's more to my discussion with Harry Kazianis, and to listen to that, visit our program page at voanews.com. Click on Live Radio, then All Programs, to select International Edition. UN High Commissioner for Refugees Filippo Grandi will present an overview of the global refugee situation in a speech at the start of the annual UNHCR Refugee Conference this week. Lisa Schlein has that story.
Forced displacement has reached record highs. In recent years, nearly 71 million people have been uprooted from their homes. More than one-third are refugees. The rest are displaced within their own countries. UN High Commissioner for Refugees Filippo Grandi says the issue of forced displacement is far more complex now than in 1951. That was when the United Nations adopted the Refugee Convention to protect and assist millions of refugees who survived the horrors of World War II. Grandi says refugee protection since has become more complex. He notes the world now is faced with what he calls mixed flows of refugees and migrants. The commissioner also says putting economic migrants and asylum seekers into the same category is eroding protections for refugees, who are people fleeing from war, persecution, and violence. In Mexico last week, he says he saw examples of refugee integration coupled with increasing migratory pressures from the region, but also from Africa.
Saving lives and safeguarding the dignity and rights of all those on the move must remain central, together with access to international protection for those with valid claims. There and elsewhere, legal migration pathways would help prevent the abuse of asylum systems as substitutes of migration channels.
Grandi says climate change is creating a new form of forcible displacement, an issue that did not exist when the Refugee Convention was conceived. He says climate-related causes are a growing driver of new internal displacement.
Climate is often also a pervasive factor in cross-border displacement. Forced displacement across borders can stem from the interaction between climate change and disasters with conflict and violence. Or it can arise from natural or man-made disasters alone. Either situation can trigger international protection needs.
Grandi says he plans to convene the first global refugee forum in just over 2 months. The aim of the forum, he says, is to address and seek to resolve forced displacement, one of the great global challenges of this century. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And that's going to do it for us today. You've been listening to International Edition of The Voice of America. On behalf of our producer, Dan Brown, our engineer, John Dryden, and managing editor, Kay Pound Dawson, thank you so much for listening. You'll be able to find in-depth coverage of world events and news at the VOA News website. And don't forget, with our VOA mobile application, you can download our stories and take them with you anytime, day or night. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Have a great day.